All right, so we're live now. Dr. Leffler, thanks so much for coming on today. How you doing?
Pleasure. I'm doing just fine. How about you?
How was your weekend? Do you have any kids?
I do have one son.
Well, congratulations. Happy Father's Day from yesterday.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Got to remember that, right?
Yep.
Cool. Excellent. So today, first, I'd like you to kind of introduce yourself in forms of, where you came from, oral surgery, where you went, the year you graduated, and then when you did law school. But just to briefly introduce what this concept would be is it's going to be like a malpractice case series. And this would be, and we'll see how many episodes we could do. You know, we'll see if we could do it once a quarter minimum. Maybe we do it once a month, but it should only be a 20 to 30 minute conversation. I know you're busy. I don't want to take up too much of your time. But if we can talk more and really round out any details, any specifics, any important concepts of these, I think that'll be very beneficial to the listeners. Sure. All listeners in dentistry on.
Yeah. I have some time, so I'm yours.
Amazing. Amazing. So let's get into it. Where did you go to dental school, actually? I don't know this.
I went to dental school at Columbia, and I graduated 1982.
Excellent.
And then I went to do my oral surgery residency at Bellevue Hospital, NYU, and I finished there 1986. After finishing, I went into kind of a hybrid between private practice and academia. I practiced with one of my attendings from my residency program and his senior partner, and they were in Midtown Manhattan. Did that, was building my practice, and then I also spent some time at NYU Dental School in the VA hospital, which was at the time part of the residency training facility, well, one of the facilities where we did our residency training. I practiced for about 9 years, I think it was, and then I went to law school, believe it or not. The reason that I ended up changing careers is that I had an injury to my dominant wrist, and it was slow coming, but I saw it coming, and it started to get, more and more painful with decreased ability to rotate. And as you know, with oral surgery, there's a lot of rotational movements, everything from extraction of teeth to doing orthodontic surgery, where you do have to exert some force. I remember people telling me way back then, if you really have to exert force, you're not doing things right. And then thinking to myself, well, that's not exactly correct. I mean, there are times when you do need to exert force. I started losing grip strength and ultimately was unable to hold instruments without dropping them. So I had started law school as a part-time evening student, and I worked during the day in my practice. And I worked as long as I could. And then once the instrument dropping became more of a routine rather than the exception, I stopped it and I went to law school full time, finished out there. And that takes care of that, and took the bar exam and I was off and running.
Actually, I'm curious, how was the bar exam compared to most of the exams through dental school, oral surgery, residency? You know how it goes. What was your take on that?
Okay. I will often say this if I'm speaking to a group of oral surgeons or dentists, if you have any friends or relatives who are lawyers and who try to tell you that law school is as difficult or more difficult than dental school, tell them they're wrong. Dental school is more difficult by far. And with the bar exam, I found the oral surgery board certification exam to be much more in-depth, difficult, more stress-inducing. Call it what you will. I'm not saying the bar exam is an easy test, but right, if you prepare for it and, you can do it well. Mm. I also, kind of found it interesting that in my law school class, there were a bunch of us, especially because I started as an evening student, there were a bunch of us who were on second careers. Mm. And the people who did the best in law school were those who had significant first careers as well. I went to law school with a guy who was an anesthesiologist who I had trained with as residents in Bellevue. We were both residents and finished the same year. Yeah, kind of a coincidence. Yeah, so those are the kinds of people who, I won't say breezed through law school, but were able to kind of take it in stride and realize what it was, what it wasn't. And if you've been in a career where people's lives are literally in your hands, you kind of realize, well, I can study this and just do just fine.
That's a good point. That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, if you handled dental school already and then you handled oral surgery residency for you, especially, I mean, I don't know if it was a breeze to walk through law school, but I'm sure it was, you're ready to go. You're ready to go as far as the studying, the exam taking strategies. So I would imagine that. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. So look, you make it work, and it's for a limited time only. And I always made sure that I had one day on the weekend that I could do stuff with my family. And that
was
That was important.
Absolutely. Yes. If times with friends and family can be tough to find in dental school, and then even more so in residency. So I definitely understand that. I know where you're coming from there.
Yeah.
So let's hop into this case right now.
Okay.
Did you send it to me on the email? Because it's not popping up.
I did.
You did, right?
You got it?
Well, you got it through, you sent it through OMS@medpro.com, like the malpractice minute?
No, I didn't. Do you want me to send it again to you?
If you can. I'm not sure why it's not popping up.
All right, let me just scoot over to another screen, make sure. Okay, you should have it now. There's a link in the middle of the email, which starts with OMS extracts.
You know, which email are you sending it to?
Oh, I'm sorry. I sent it to Brendan Gallagher or Brendan Middle. I don't know. Brendan Gallagher at Gmail.
Is it Brendan K. Gallagher by any chance?
I need to get closer for that one. Nope, just Brendan Gallagher. Should I send it to Brendan K?
Oh, that's why. That's why. It's Brendan K. Gallagher at Gmail.
Okay. Yeah. Let me do it again. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Okay.
Hopefully. Yeah, Brendan, B-R-E-N-D-A-N, K. Gallagher at gmail.com.
Looks like it went through, but you tell me.
Oh, there it is. Look at that. Bingo.
Got it. Okay.
All right. Let me open this up because I wanted to share it. OMS extracts wrong tooth and faces litigation.
That's it. That's the one.
Got it. Okay. Let me share the screen so that viewers can see this and follow along, at least briefly. Camera. Share. Here we go. Bingo. Okay.
Got it.
So this is the article right here. So this is MedPro's. What was that?
Nope. Yeah. I interrupted. Go for it. You're good.
All good. All good. So this is, and also Dr. Leffler, how often are you putting this out? Is this once a month?
Roughly once a month. Yes.
Excellent. And so please.
The series is called Malpractice Minutes. So the goal, big picture of the series, and I do one set of closed case studies, which is what these are, for oral surgeons, dedicated to oral surgeons, and another set for, I'll call it dentists, pretty much everybody else. The purpose is to essentially educate people to understand the whole concept of malpractice and what kinds of issues play out. They're closed case studies with an asterisk. And the reason the asterisk is there, that I will often change some facts which are not critical to the case presentation. But if it's a male, I might make it a female. If it's a 25-year-old, I might make it a 35-year-old. Because I don't want, especially the dentist whose case this was, or the oral surgeon whose case this was, to read it and say, oh, no, that's my case. I really don't want it out there for the world to see.
Of course. Of course. No, that's a great point. You're basically HIPAA protecting it. I got you.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was a kid, there was a show called Dragnet on TV, and they would say the names have changed to protect the innocent. And that's exactly what this is.
Right. So why don't we hop right into this? This is excellent.
Okay. So this one is a little bit different from a lot of the other case studies in the series, in that we have been getting a number of inquiries from oral surgeons who we insured, saying to us, well, we don't really understand what the whole process is, like from start to finish. So I decided to do a short set of background facts on an unfortunately very common incident, which is extraction of the wrong tooth. So use that as background and then follow that with, okay, this becomes a case. What happens next? What are the stepwise progressions that it goes through? Understanding that not every case is the same and it might vary a little bit from one situation to another. But this is basically the big picture on this particular malpractice minute.
Excellent. Thank you for that explanation of it and where this particular one came from. Also, I just had a quick idea while we're at the beginning of the episode. You know, Dr. Leffler, we were talking about this last week. You had said there were already six cases that came in this year, you were saying, right? Six deaths with sedation. It's very unfortunate. If you can describe some of these a little more, and maybe we can touch on the fact of, you know, who was doing the IV sedation, kind of just very briefly, how it happened, how it arose, and, you know, what kind of dentistry this was that was going on. Was it oral surgeons versus other specialties?
Yeah. So The good news for oral surgeons is that it did not involve oral surgeons, or the cases this year to date anyway have not. The majority have been pediatric dentists. There's a lot of pediatric anesthesia slash sedation that goes on for obvious reasons. But as somebody once told me when I was doing my anesthesia rotation, kids are not little adults. They have their own sets of physiology. They respond differently, their tolerances from therapeutic level to toxic level are far different from what you would usually find in an adult patient.
Right.
What we have found, and I always make this distinction because people try to kind of anesthesia, or I should say it the other way, sedation as a separate and distinct thing from anesthesia, meaning general anesthesia. And I always take issue with that because it's a range. And you start out, you give a dose of some sedative medication, and some patient might be just like staring there looking at you, having a conversation as though you gave them nothing, whereas the next patient might be kind of out cold snoring. I'm exaggerating a bit, but just totally the other end of the spectrum. So whereas you might, intend to just sedate somebody, meaning essentially having them in a conscious state, having more of the protective reflexes available to them for themselves, sometimes they wander, if you will, into the state of general anesthesia, where they're far deeper, they have less protective reflexes. You have to be much more cognizant of being totally in sync with what their vital signs are, et cetera, et cetera. So that is the distinction that I like to make to point out that it is a range. So once you set out to do sedation, usually what people set out to do more moderate of deep sedation, it can very easily invade into the area of general anesthesia. So I'm always concerned that they may not be able to appropriately handle emergencies that might come up with the deeper stages, thinking, oh, I'm just doing a little sedation to this patient. I don't need to worry about potentially losing an airway.
And Got it.
I worry about that. So to answer your earlier question, the cases that we have seen so far this year, and last year was a similar representation in total, is that a good number of the cases are from pediatric dentists. We have some cases that are general dentists or perhaps a periodontist who's doing something of a surgical procedure who brings in an outside dental anesthesiologist or somebody else who perhaps is not formally trained in dental anesthesiology, but according to that state's statutes, allows that person, based upon whatever continuing ed they may have taken, to do the sedation.
So like a week-long course, they get their certificate. Just to define that more clearly, it's,
So there's a lot of difference between the states. Some states are very liberal, so to speak, as to who is permitted to do various stages of anesthesia. And again, my same concern, they'll allow a dentist who has, to use your example, a week of an anesthesia course to do mild sedation or light sedation, however they might refer to it. But what if it wanders into a deeper state? So that's my concern. I also have seen with a lot of these cases that there is not adequate resuscitative equipment available, not the traditional crash cart with all of the appropriate meds and intubation equipment, et cetera. So what generally happens, and it is an overgeneralization, but that the patient loses their airway, either suddenly or because of a slow progressive move toward a deeper state. And nobody's watching as diligently as they really should be. So those are the kinds of things that generally get into a troubling and problematic situation.
Yeah.
So, you know, as all oral surgeons will know, you know, part of our training is certainly in emergency management of a lost airway, good ability to intubate, in most situations, look, some intubations are going to be difficult, but in most situations, because you've done it enough, you can do it if need be. But you have to have the appropriate equipment there standing by. And something that's often left out of the equation, somebody with you who can assist you in the proper way, not be an impediment, but really an aid to reaching the final goal. And that's somebody that needs to be trained so that they know what you want in the event of one of these problematic situations arising, and to have adequate training, at the very least, basic life support, preferably advanced cardiac life support.
Let's do it. Let's get into this case. Okay. Yeah, I didn't mean to. Yeah.
I like the versions. They're perfectly great with me.
Yeah, these are great. This is great. We're really getting, because this is knowledge that I didn't get through residency on the actual stats of what's going on out there, you know, and how serious it is. You got to take all these things into account. Just like you're saying, someone who knows what to give you when you need it, why, could basically, you know, a lot of the dental assistants, they could like read your mind before things even happen.
Right.
And especially in sedation, it's so important.
Yep, absolutely. All right. So anyhow, so what this case involves is, as I started out by saying, an unfortunate but common event where the wrong tooth is extracted. And you can imagine that's not a case that's easy to defend, if defensible at all. So the good news, if you will, if you want to look at it that way, is that we look at the damages as being not very severe. I mean, it's certainly comparing it to an anesthesia mishap, it's a totally different end of the spectrum. But with the availability and frequent use of implants these days, a tooth can be replaced with an implant and function is usually pretty good over the long haul. But that doesn't take away from the fact that it's a difficult liability situation to manage if it goes to litigation or a threat of litigation, and we have to deal with that.
Yeah.
So feel free to tell me to close my mouth because I tend to talk a lot. You know, lawyers tend to do that, but interrupt.
So what happened in this particular case with, I mean, so they took out the wrong, they took out the wrong tooth on an 18-year-old male.
Yeah. So
it was, yeah.
Yeah. So this was a young guy who needed orthodontics, and he had a congenitally missing tooth on the upper left. So he ended up having a leftward shift, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so he goes to an orthodontist who says, well, I think we should take out one of your upper right bicuspids, and then we'll do a shift moving everything toward the right. And by the way, you also have an excessive overjet, so I can bring everything back, retract the upper anteriors a bit so that you would have a more appropriate anterior alignment. So that was the goal. So to remove one of those upper bicuspids. This is a common scenario where an orthodontist refers the patient to an oral surgeon to extract that tooth. But it could just as easily have been, and we see it, a referral back to the patient's general dentist to do the extraction. As you know, dentistry has a number of tooth numbering systems. So we have the universal system from 1 to 32, and then we have the quadrant system, which at least in the past, it was called Palmer quadrant. And then you have the Federation Dentaire International, the FDI system, which is similar to the quadrant system, except instead of calling things upper right quadrant, it will call it quadrant one. So you can have, and we do have, teeth that have multiple numbers or different numbering schemes, depending upon which one of those scenarios the dentist involved is using. So for example, in this case, I want to just look, the tooth that was asked to be removed was, quote, tooth five on the upper right. So I see that as being pretty confusing. So do you mean tooth number five, or do you mean the upper right five?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right? Which in the FDI system would be 1-5. So that's crazy, you know, not to be confused with the upper left second molar. So what happened was the patient was referred to this oral surgeon with that instruction to extract tooth 5 on the upper right. So the oral surgeon, upon seeing the patient and seeing the referral, was confused, and rightfully so. So what she did was she asked her staff to contact the orthodontics or the orthodontist's office. Let's get some clarity about what we're doing here.
Absolutely. Yeah,
because it's an understandably confusing situation. So at the instruction of the oral surgeon, her front desk staff member, office manager, I suppose, contacted the orthodontist's office and got the instruction back, the upper right 5 tooth. To me, just as confusing. And I think there's a step here from a risk perspective, because I focus a lot upon risk management, risk elimination. And there was a step right here. If the oral surgeon herself had gotten on the phone with the orthodontist and said, I need some clarification here, specifically which tooth do you want removed, the upper right first or second premolar? No problem. Issues solved before it becomes an issue. But what happened was that it was delegated, which not uncommon. I don't love it from a risk perspective, delegated to a non-dentist staff member to make the call, speaking to another non-dentist staff member on the other side of the phone.
Absolutely. You got to call the provider directly. You have to call the orthodontist, right? We do this all the time. Dr. Fleischer at our program was very, very influential in kind of mitigating risk as far as like things that could become legal issues. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you got to call them directly.
Yeah.
And just to give some background really briefly, in oral surgery residency, we're doing premolars left and right. It's almost an everyday thing, especially every day on the peds days. There's probably 5 patients that we have to take out premolars on. So this is a very common thing. And we usually refer to teeth, at least at my program in oral surgery, 1 through 32, right? Uh-huh. Just like we said. But there's so many different systems. And the ortho department usually says like the upper right number 5, meaning the 5th tooth from the midline. So just relating that back to this case, Dr. Leffler, do we know which was genitally missing? Was it the upper left first or second premolar? Because they're saying upper left bicuspid. I'm trying to see if I missed it. You know what I mean? Because that could also...
Yeah. The facts as presented here don't specify. It's just that it was an upper left bicuspid. But I hear your point that it might have assisted in some way. But that's not information that was transmitted from the orthodontist to the oral surgeon in any event. And that's where these facts come from, what was transmitted. So she, meaning the oral surgeon, did not know what that background information was. So what happens is she goes ahead and extracts the upper right second bicuspid premolar, whichever you like, which is the upper right 5 or tooth number 4, whichever of those two numbering systems we're talking about. And the extraction itself went perfectly fine. Patient leaves, heals, does beautifully, goes back to the orthodontist, and the orthodontist looks in the mouth and said, whoa, I did not want the second bicuspid removed. I wanted the first bicuspid removed. So, you know, is it really a big deal? Probably not. I mean, orthodontics is going to go on either way, but perhaps one was wider than the other by a significant enough amount that the treatment plan then needed to be altered somewhat to modify it. But ultimately, the orthodontics was done. You could say much ado about nothing. It gets a little bit sticky if this were not an orthodontics case per se, where the space could be made up, but the kind of orthodontics case where you couldn't make that space up, and then you're left with the wrong tooth extracted. As you can imagine, sometimes when a wrong tooth extraction happens, that still means that the tooth that was slated to be extracted still needs to come out. So, you know, then you have 2 teeth missing instead of the 1. Can you repair it effectively, make the patient whole by placing an implant and then restoring the implant? Yes, you can. But
yeah,
those are damages.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get to MedPro's involvement in this. So it looks like that the oral surgeon contacted you guys, the insurance provider, right, and just kind of explained the situation.
Yeah. It's very common when the insured oral surgeon or dentist, whomever it might be, after realizing, and she realized it by the conversation from the orthodontist, that, oops, I made a mistake here. I want to notify my insurance carrier just so that I'm fully covered in the event that it proceeds to a lawsuit, which is always the smart thing to do. And she called and she described the situation pretty much as I've described it. And at that point, you know, we call it an incident. That's how we refer to it. Note the doctor's file as an incident, meaning we only know that something happened. We don't know about anything legal yet. Nothing legal has happened. But what happened next from a timeline perspective is that the patient then contacted an attorney. The attorney writes a letter to the oral surgeon and says, you know, in essence, this is what happened. You know what happened. And, you know, we want to be compensated. Or in some way, they talk about how they think there should be an appropriate remedy given to the patient who was inappropriately treated. Then what she did, again, appropriate, she went ahead and notified MedPro. And what we call it at that point is a claim, because there's actually a letter either from the patient or the patient's attorney saying, putting it in writing, essentially, you've made a mistake here. We want to be compensated in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, we can get into a discussion of claims made versus occurrence policies, and maybe we could do that in another session. But suffice it to say, if the oral surgeon here had an occurrence policy, it wouldn't make a difference if she had reported it before lawsuit was filed, whereas if she had a claims made, it possibly could. If, for example, the claim was made, the lawyer's letter came in a year later and she had changed insurance programs. But we can leave that for another day. I just moved off to that for a quick second.
Yeah.
Anyhow, it's a claim at this point, and it's noted in her file. And then life goes on until somebody shows up at her door, a process server, and says, here, doctor, I have some papers for you, which it's called the summons and complaint, the initiating documents of a lawsuit. This is for you. Have a nice day, and leaves. That's known as service of process. It's not a good day in the life of any dental practitioner, life of an oral surgeon. She turned that over, forwarded it. Usually we do it by email, but some people may be more old school. They want to actually send it by FedEx or such. We get it. And at that point, it is a lawsuit. It is a full-fledged action, we call it in legal terms, but it is a lawsuit in more lay terms. And what we do first, we assign it to a claims consultant. And probably in this case, the claims consultant would have been assigned it in the case as a claim, maybe not as an incident, but as a claim. And they look through it, have a conversation with the oral surgeon. But once the lawsuit's filed, that claims consultant says, okay, we are going to assign one of our panel attorneys who does dental malpractice on a regular basis to defend you. They get all the documents. And there's always a first conversation between attorney and now sued oral surgeon, who's called in legal terms the defendant. It's what it usually is. It's a general conversation where the attorney is going to ask the oral surgeon, first of all, for a complete set of her records. That has to be exchanged, no questions asked, but also for an explanation of what happened. Give me the facts. Tell me why you think it happened. What's the behind the scenes story? essentially here, meaning two non-dentists involved in a phone conversation. They got it wrong. That's pretty much what it comes down to. But the person with the forceps or scalpel in hand is the one who's responsible for what happened ultimately.
Right, right. So it looks like they did go on to the defense attorney gave a document known as the answer.
Right.
And then the discovery phase began.
Yeah. So the answer is just a pro forma document saying nothing was done wrong here. And that's always said up front. Because if you don't say that, then you are saying from the beginning, I am liable. I am responsible. I did something wrong. So you need to have the lawyer do that. And they will. That's standard fare. They deny any wrongdoing. And that served on the attorney for the patient, who's now called the plaintiff. And it, as you mentioned a second ago, it begins the phase of the case called discovery. So discovery is literally what the word sounds like. Each side discovers what the opposing side has in terms of approaches to argue that there was liability versus approaches toward defense.
Mm.
And it comes out gradually over the course of this discovery period. Lots of documents filed. That's all lawyer stuff. Usually the oral surgeon's not involved at all with that. Perhaps the lawyer might make a phone call periodically. There's a term here that I don't understand. Can you please explain it to me? Mm-hmm. Or can you tell me, you know, it's the date is not clear. Explain that. So little factors that are not easily discernible, the lawyer might get the oral surgeon involved to answer those. But also there are periodic check-ins so that the oral surgeon who was sued knows what's going on. We all want to know what's going on. It keeps our stress level down. And the most important part of discovery in my book is something called deposition, where it's sworn statement, essentially, a kind of relaxed atmosphere, usually in a lawyer's office. But relaxed as the atmosphere might be, it's the most important part of the pretrial case. And what it comes down to is the opposing lawyer asks each person involved in the case questions under oath, and they need to answer them. And then it's transcribed by a court stenographer and put into a booklet, and that can be used at trial. And it is almost 100% of the time.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So the discovery phase goes forward. And at the end of the discovery phase, the court is advised, we're done with discovery. We need to get this case on the trial calendar. That's the pretrial phase. And that really gets the ball rolling a lot. There are always experts involved in malpractice case. By definition, there must be an expert.
Mm.
Although an oral surgeon who is sued may act as his or her own expert if they choose. It's not ideal for sure. That's why we usually have outside experts doing it. But anyhow, everybody gets to know. Again, it's the same concept as discovery. We know who your expert is. You know who our expert is and what theories they're going to put in front of a jury at trial. And what we offer is a consent policy, which some of the carriers may not. What consent says, if you have it in your policy, and all of ours do, you have a right to withhold consent from settlement. So you could say, I am dead set sure. I did absolutely nothing wrong. I do not want to settle this case. If the plaintiff is going to get any money, they're going to have to get it from a jury after back and forth opposing experts, after my testimony, meaning the defendant oral surgeon. And if you exercise that withholding of consent, then the case is going to trial, period. If you say, no, I'd rather not take a week or a week and a half out of my work schedule, take those days off, deal with the stress, I'd rather you try to settle it. And if we feel that it's a case that should be settled, we'll go ahead and try to settle it. And sometimes, though, the amount of money that's sought is just so extreme that it becomes absurd, and we do end up trying it either way. But for the most part, once there's an agreement by the doctor that they would like the case to be settled, most of the time it does end up going that way.
Mm. Do you know how this one set? It looks like it might not have gone to the next phase. Is that right?
Yeah, in this case, the way I set it up, it did not go to the next phase. Yeah, it just ends there because I wanted to leave it with almost the hypothetical ending. But I did talk about what the general trial process is, and there's a selection of a jury. That process is called voir dire. Both of the lawyers are involved in that. A jury is seated. The plaintiff puts their evidence on first, whether that might be in the form of documents, which we call documentary evidence. It might be in the form of testimonial evidence. And that comes, at least from the plaintiff's perspective, the plaintiff would testify, him or herself. They would have an expert, perhaps more, if the case required it, to essentially say that oral surgeon did not abide by the standard of care, and it caused the following injury or injuries to the plaintiff. That's big picture what it is. On the other side of the coin, the defense case is the defendant, him or herself, would testify. They would say, I did nothing wrong here because this is why X, Y, and Z. There was nothing done wrong here. The defendant need only refute one phase of the case, meaning either say prove that there was no liability, meaning nothing was done wrong, or there are no damages, or the damages were not caused by negligence. Just one of those, the defendant wins. So anyhow, so the defendant would testify, and then an expert, usually on behalf of the defendant, would testify as well to further cement nothing was done here, or else it did not cause injury to the patient.
I got it. Yeah. I got that. What would be the average? Does it depend upon like what tooth was removed incorrectly? The average settled payment that is usually gone through for, say I take out the wrong tooth on a patient, say it is a premolar, mm-hmm. they want another premolar, goes to the litigation and everything, and they're trying to settle, if you know the average number by any chance.
It's very variable based upon where you are located. I can't emphasize that enough. So like—
What does that mean? Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah.
So there are some places in the country, even some places specific within a state that are where the juries tend to give out more money. So New York is one of those places where juries tend to give out more. New York, New Jersey, Georgia, Illinois, California, Texas. Those are kind of the biggies.
Huh.
Some of the Midwestern states that are more rural tend to have jurors that, you know, they, I don't want to say they like their doctors more, but they have more of an old school respect for doctors that, you know, they're on a little bit of a higher pedestal kind of.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they tend not to find in favor of the patient and against the doctor as much. And so, and then even in New York, if you just look at the five boroughs of New York City, Brooklyn, Queens, New York City, and the Bronx tend to be more plaintiff favorable, meaning the juries tend to be more in favor. Staten Island, not so much. If you go way upstate, like toward the Canadian border, again, not so much. So it matters where in the state, and it matters which state. But not to diffuse your question, so without I can't tell you a number because repairing quotes, numbers are different. For example, you take out the wrong tooth. Forget about the orthodontics in this case. You just take out a wrong tooth. How can you make the patient back to whole? As we talked about before, place an implant, let it integrate, place a crown, essentially you're good to go. So what is the cost of that? Well, let's say an implant in environment around New York City, maybe I'm underestimating $2,500 to $3,000. You tell me if I'm wrong. And then a crown, maybe $3,000, $3,500. So you add those things up. You're looking at about $6,000 roughly out of pocket. If you go I'll pick South Dakota, for example, rural South Dakota. it's going to be a mere fraction of that. So the goal of tort law is to make a patient whole. So there's two components. They have to go through the procedures. That's very subjective. But the objective component is, how much is it going to cost me? So whereas something might cost $6,000 in New York, it might cost $2,000 in South Dakota. Then you have to look at what's the age of the patient, because, I mean, there are those who might think that implants just tend to go bad over time. I'm not so sure, but certainly crowns do need to be replaced with some frequency over time. So that usually is figured in. Let's say a patient's 20 years old, a life expectancy on average, say 80. So you have 60 more years of life. How many times will a crown have to be replaced? Say three. And everything is done by today's dollar, not a future dollar, at least in New York.
That's interesting. Yeah. This is a lot of information to digest. I didn't even expect that. And that's interesting. You said Staten Island, not so much more on the defendant's side than the plaintiff.
Yeah, it is.
But what about Suffolk County? I'm curious because I'll be in Suffolk, maybe Nassau a little bit.
Suffolk tends to be more defendant oriented even than Nassau County. Yeah, there you go. Good place. Good choice. But the, you know, Long Island is sort of middle of the road generally, but Suffolk's a better place to be a little bit more than Nassau.
More or less.
Yeah. And then, you know, in the city, as I said, maybe Westchester mimics the city a bit. And the farther away you get, the more rural the area, the more defendant oriented it tends to be.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
The science behind these issues, you know?
Yeah. And you know what's really weird, and I saw it during years of practice, because I practiced trial law for 23 years. So I saw a whole lot of juries. And in the same venue, which is the same county, one week you might have, let's take Suffolk County, for example. One week they might draw their jurors from very affluent areas, like, say, the Hamptons, for example. Another week they might draw their jurors from a less affluent area, let's say Riverhead or Wading River, some of those towns out there. You're going to, same case, same county, same judge, you might get very, very different results just because of the luck of the draw. Who is the jury clerk calling in their jurors for that week from?
Wow. That's crazy how it could be variable. It reminds me of that show Bull, where it was like a trial scientist who used to, maybe you've seen it. But so that actually has a very big impact on the cases, what you're saying.
Most certainly. It really does. You can't quantify it. So you have to just kind of look at the big picture and you say, okay, Suffolk is a decent venue. Bronx is not. It's kind of the opposite end of the coin. And that's the best you can do going in if you want to try to do crystal ball or reading tea leaf stuff.
Man. Hey, this has been a really helpful and insightful episode. Thanks for doing it. You were great today.
Thank you. Thanks.
Would you be down for doing this more often?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
I'll send you a text after this, and then I'll let Brooke know that we spoke too. Okay. I'll send you a text after this. Maybe we could, you know, get a date, like to make sure that we got something locked in the books. This has been very, very helpful, and I hope listeners can take this and begin this on a series of where we can learn how to not let problems happen, right? It's always about doing good by the patient, but how do you prevent certain mistakes that other people have had that have been, you know, why stop at the bottom of the heap of mistakes and start at the top? And that's why I figured this episode and hopefully we could get a series of it going. What are your thoughts? I was thinking maybe putting a title like for this one specifically, wrong tooth extracted. And then it'll be like us on the podcast. Maybe I'll put a picture of the article or something or in the back or in the front. I'm not really sure, but do you think that works? And then I'll put Dr. Mark Leffler with MedPro.
Yeah. That works. One thing I'm not is a great marketing guru, so I kind of like defer that stuff to you. That's kind of your expertise, but it sounds like a good idea. You know, usually some tagline which catches people's attention.
Exactly.
And who was attention wouldn't be caught by saying wrong tooth extracted? Of course. Right? Absolutely.
And it gives you a very quick introduction to what the case is going to be. And then I'll put like malpractice case series number one, you know, and then I'll put a dash oral surgery. And then maybe, hey, you know, here's another idea. Today's oral surgery, right? Or, you know, generally extracting teeth.
Yep.
The next one, let's get into, you said certain cases that apply more for like general dentistry.
Yeah.
Well, would you consider this one general dentistry or oral surgery since it was a surgeon?
Because it was a surgeon, I consider it an oral surgery case. But Again, this is the kind of case, it's simple enough surgery that it's probably done as much by general dentists as oral surgeons.
Right, right. And can happen. The mistake can happen by general dentists as well. That's excellent. Let's do, for the next one, you want to do like a sedation case and maybe within general dentistry or pediatric dentistry. When you say oral surgery and then general, you meant like other specialties or specifically general?
Okay. No, oral surgeons in one group and then everybody else in the other.
Got it. Because some of the more invasive things can lead to
More
invasive mistakes, if you will. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But I certainly have prior case studies with sedation. We can talk about that next.
Let's do it. Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. I think this is going to turn into something fun. I'm having a good time. I hope you like this form. Is this format okay?
Yeah,
we zoom in.
Actually, it's really good because it's nice and relaxed and we can just go back and forth like we're having a conversation and
exactly
talking about some serious stuff.
Yeah. And it's just conversation, you know, and I find that to be the easiest digestible way. You know, it's easy listening for people too, and they could take a couple points back with them. Excellent. Great. So we got another one set up. Thanks for coming on today, Dr. Leftfeather. This is awesome.
My pleasure. And look forward to the next one. You know, throw out some dates that might work for you. And, you know, I have some travel in July and August, so we'll come up with something that works.
Perfect. How about you send me the dates that you're traveling and then we'll go around that. How about that?
Works for me.
Okay. Because I'm going to be away too in July, actually. That's a great month. So.
Okay. Yeah.
Excellent.
All right.
All right, Doug Leffler.
Good luck in your new venture, which should be starting any day now, I suppose.
No, I got until August. Oh. So we're going to try and get some time. And
Wonderful. Right. So you're going to Ireland, right?
Yes.
Dig up
UK,
your roots.
Ireland. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
To see the roots a little bit, see the areas. It would be my first time there. So I'm pretty pumped for that.
Yeah. Well, if I can give my best takeaway from Ireland, other than the people in general being absolutely wonderful, which they are. Before going to Ireland, I used to look at Guinness as motor oil. And I figured if it tastes like it looks, not interested. I had my first Guinness there a year ago in Ireland. I loved it.
No way.
I'm sold.
It's not motor oil. You found out.
Yeah, it's great. I love it.
There's a reason. There's a reason that everyone, it's so popular and everyone drinks it. And did you know the Guinness Book of World Records is obviously related to Guinness, the factory. Apparently, like a lot of people would get beers after work and they were interested in trivia. And as we know, trivia contests at like breweries and stuff. I don't know, just fun little history fact there.
You know, I hadn't thought about it, but yeah, it makes sense, of course.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Dr. Leff. Well, thanks so much again, and we'll plan the dates for next month.
Sounds good. I'll send you some dates that are not good, and then we can take it from there.
Perfect.
All right.
All right. You have a good afternoon.
You too. Take me well.
All right. Bye.